Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole... That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
I see. And we're taking that out of context, are we? I don't think
well,
so.
I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling there's something right.
It ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also elsewhere in California, in Oregon, in Pennsylvania, in Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, West Virginia, Washington State, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com with what you can tell is already, you can tell, it's going to be a busy show. Had to truncate the opening.
Yes, but we love all our affiliates anyway.
Yes, we do. We will share them with you at another time. Voters headed to the polls for presidential primaries and more on Tuesday in Arizona, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, and Ohio. Florida, however, has canceled the Democratic presidential primary in the Sunshine State due to a state law which removes races from the ballot when there is just one candidate running. As President Biden is the only candidate submitted by the state Democratic Party to run in that state's primary, there will be no contest on the Democratic side there. Joe Biden will be awarded all of the state's available 224 delegates, though each of the leading candidates in both parties, President Biden for the Democrats and Donald Trump for the Republicans, have already won the number of delegates needed in their respective parties to win the nominations at each party's national convention this summer. There were still other names on the ballot in each of those presidential races and a number of other important races on each of the state's ballots, such as a primary race for U.S. Senate on the Republican side in Ohio, where another MAGA loon has been endorsed by Donald Trump to run against the candidate selected by the more establishment Republicans, if establishment Republicans is even the right way now to describe those who have yet to drink the full glass of Trump Kool-Aid, Desi Doyen.
This is true. We don't, there's still some out there, apparently.
I guess, maybe, a little.
Hard to tell.
We will also, of course, be keeping an eye out for a number of other data points from Tuesday, even in the presidential contest regarding turnout on each side, if it might be used to tell us anything about enthusiasm for the candidates and how many turn out to vote for someone other than their party's presumptive nominees at this point. Kansas, by the way, will also have an option for none of the names shown on its presidential primary ballot for both Republicans and Democrats. So that'll be interesting to watch. And of course, we'll keep our eyes out for any problems at the polls reported on Tuesday. There are also other races of potential note around the country, including special primary elections for the U.S. House in California to fill the seat vacated by ousted Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. So if there are any noteworthy results or problems reported by tomorrow, we will, of course, share them on our next thrilling broadcast. And if you have or see any problems at the polls around the country, of course, between now and then, feel free, please, to let me know by email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. For the record, as we go to air, there are 118 days until the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. Write that down, Dizzy Doyen. 153 days until the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And when have Democratic National Conventions in Chicago ever gone wrong? And there are 231 days until the most critical presidential election in this country that we have ever seen. That will be on November 5 of this year, in case you want to mark that down. And with just 231 days until the election, Donald Trump's former White House advisor, Peter Navarro, reported to prison in Miami on Tuesday as the first senior Trump official to go to jail related to Trump's attempt to steal the 2020 election. Navarro was sentenced to 4 months in prison for criminal contempt of Congress after refusing to respond to subpoenas from the bipartisan House January 6 committee. He also made history as the first former White House official ever to be imprisoned for a contempt of Congress conviction. So
really?
Congratulations to Mr. Navarro.
Wow.
There.
So many firsts.
His last-ditch effort to the to make an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court to stay out of jail pending appeal in his case was rejected late on Monday by Chief Justice John Roberts. The other former Trump aide to also be found guilty of the very same crime would be Steve Bannon. He was also sentenced to 4 months in jail. He remains free, however, during his appeal, which was heard by a different judge. Bannon, of course, is now hoping to basically run out the clock until November on his appeal, when he hopes that Trump will win and will issue a quick pardon to keep him from taking any personal responsibility for his crimes. Trump has already pardoned Bannon previously for his federal indictment for pocketing money from Trump donors to a private so-called Build the Wall campaign. Though Bannon was pardoned as Trump was on his way out of office for that crime, New York State has since indicted Bannon for pretty much the same crimes at the state level, which even if Trump wins in November, he will not be able to issue a pardon to Steve Bannon for, since presidents have no clemency or pardon power regarding state crimes. Navarro may be the first senior advisor of Trump's to go to the Juscow, at least in relation to Trump's attempt to steal the 2020 election, though he's hardly the first one to go to jail for other crimes related to Donald Trump in various ways, such as Trump's 2016 campaign chair and deputy chair. They went to jail. Trump's former attorney and a bunch of advisors that Trump ended up pardoning after they were sentenced, but before they could serve time. So there are a whole bunch of Trump folks like Trump himself who are now still facing charges for their roles in their failed effort to steal the election from Joe Biden and the American people back in 2020. And there have been more than 1,200 rank-and-file January 6th insurrectionists who have been federally indicted, with hundreds of them already convicted and now serving time for their part in attempting to overthrow the U.S. Constitution on January 6th. But what's perhaps most remarkable is that these wingnut Donald Trump zombies are still either pretending or deluding themselves into believing that there was a massive election fraud conspiracy back in 2020 that somehow stole the election from their dear leader, despite more than 3 years and still zero evidence of such a massive conspiracy. Man, those Democrats are good at it. Now, I'm not talking about rank-and-file MAGA dupes here who will believe anything that this dope tells them at this point, apparently. I'm talking about actual professionals, attorneys in this case, who are still choking that same 2020 election denial chicken, no matter how much it is going to cost them in both money and or prison time. An attorney facing criminal charges for illegally accessing Michigan voting machines after the 2020 election was arrested on Monday after a hearing in a separate case in federal court in Washington, D.C. Stephanie Lambert was arrested by U.S. Marshals. She's an attorney. After a hearing over possible sanctions against her for disseminating confidential emails from Dominion Voting Systems, the target of false conspiracy theories over Trump's 2020 election loss. Lambert obtained these Dominion emails that were not supposed to be shared publicly. She obtained them because she represents former Overstock.com founder and billionaire and election denialist Patrick Byrne, who is being sued by Dominion for defamation and represented by Lambert, who is facing her own state charges back in Michigan. A Michigan judge earlier this month issued an arrest warrant for Lambert because she missed a hearing in her own case in which she's charged with four felonies for accessing voting machines in a search for some sort of voting system fraud that was committed against Trump. Apparently, she never found any such evidence. Lambert had earlier unsuccessfully sued to overturn Trump's loss in Michigan. Lambert contended the Dominion documents that were obtained under discovery were evidence of crimes and needed to be disclosed. She is an attorney. She knows better. She doesn't care.
She knows it doesn't work that way.
Dominion Voting on Friday had filed a motion demanding that Lambert be removed from the Patrick Byrne case where she is representing him in their in Dominion suit against him for defamation, for violating they want her to be removed from the case for violating a protective order that the U.S. District Judge Court overseeing the case had placed on the discovery documents. Dominion charged that Lambert's disclosure had triggered a new round of threats toward the company, which has for years now been at the center of this elaborate, wholly evidence-free conspiracy regarding Trump's loss. Quote, "These actions should shock the conscience," Dominion wrote in its motion seeking to disqualify Lambert from the case. "They reflect a total disregard for this court's orders, to say nothing of the safety of Dominion employees." But that is not what she was arrested for. She was arrested for failing to show up for a hearing in her own trial in Michigan for being part of the Trump conspiracy, where the actual Trump conspiracy, where right-wing operatives organized by Trump attorney Sidney Powell unlawfully breached voting system hardware and software in Michigan and also in Coffee County, Georgia, as you may have heard on this show, and other states, in crimes that have real election integrity experts that we've spoken with many times on this show concerned that the information stolen from those systems back in 2020 could now be used by Republican operatives to steal the 2024 election for Donald Trump. Dominion, for their part in their case against Byrne, as you know, have filed several defamation lawsuits against those who have spread conspiracy theories blaming their voting systems for Trump's 2020 loss. Fox News most famously settled the most prominent of those cases for $787 million last year. That was just last year, by the way.
It feels like a
forever
thousand
ago.
Years
I know. Dominion's suit against Patrick Byrne is one of several that the company has filed against prominent deniers, including Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani, MyPillow founder Mike Lindell. But these people like Stephanie Lambert, an attorney who almost certainly knows better, but continues to violate the law anyway over these still false and still evidence-free claims made by Trump that the election was stolen. These are the type of people that literally drink the Kool-Aid when their cult leader tells them to. Literally the type of stooges and dupes who are dumb enough to actually, yes, kill themselves, or perhaps more troublingly, kill others if they were told to do so by their vindictive cult leader, which is just one of the things that makes what happened over the weekend in Ohio, where Trump held a rally in Vandalia just outside of Dayton, and as wannabe strongmen do, continued to up his political violence rhetoric that, thankfully, many in the mainstream corporate media have begun to notice and are actually discussing in the days since it happened. As AP notes today, Republican Donald Trump has launched his general election campaign, not merely rewriting the history of the January 6, 2021 Capitol attack, but positioning the violent siege and its failed attempt to overturn the 2020 election as a cornerstone of his bid to return to the White House. This weekend at the rally in Ohio, as author and historian Timothy Snyder pointed out, he has an expertise in the rise of tyranny and fascism. He writes today that the rally, quote, began with a brazen celebration of the convicted criminals who took part in Trump's failed coup.
Ladies and gentlemen, please rise for the horribly and unfairly treated January 6th hostages.
All right. Yeah, that's how it started.
Wow.
The beginning of this rally over the weekend in Ohio. As Snyder notes, the phrase horribly and unfairly treated January 6 hostages booming over the loudspeaker was substituted here for the call to rise to the flag or the national anthem. The people who tried to overthrow the Constitution were inserted where a pledge to American values would ordinarily be. Americans were being asked to honor violence in service of overthrowing the American system. As a chorus of convicted criminals sang, people rose and joined in song with the coup convicts. In doing so, they joined a virtual community of violence, he notes. Snyder writes, the singing was interwoven with a recording of Trump reciting the Pledge of Allegiance as though he were the only American who mattered. Baseball cap still on head, which I hadn't realized until Snyder pointed that out. He kept his cap on.
He certainly did.
During the national anthem and the Pledge of Allegiance. During that, he saluted what was a recording of himself giving the Pledge of Allegiance. Both of these details, too, are mockeries of patriotic performance, writes Snyder. Not removing the cap means that he, and he alone, is above it all. The martyr in chief, the most horribly and unfairly treated of them all. Quote, they were unbelievable patriots, Trump said as the recording ended, having previously vowed to pardon the rioters. He promised to help them the first day we get into office, AP noted. And by the way, I remember back in I think it was a month or so after January 6th, back in 2021, I think we were talking to Colin Clark, was it at the time? Political violence expert.
Yes.
And he said, back at the time, he suggested that January 6th would be used as a recruitment technique.
Yes, he said he was already seeing it being used as a recruitment technique among neo-Nazis and white supremacist groups that he studies and follows.
Which I thought was remarkable at the time, back in February of 2021, when it was so clearly a disgrace what had happened on January 6th. And he said, nope, they're going to be using that. I think he said for a decade into the future.
Yep.
Apparently he was right. And maybe you heard it here first on the broadcast. In any event, back to AP, having previously vowed to pardon the rioters, he promised to help them the first day we get into office. Initially relegated to a fringe theory on the edges of the Republican Party, the revisionist history of January 6th remains a centerpiece, even as Trump has already won the delegates necessary to clinch the nomination, and as he now, in theory, must appeal more broadly to a general election audience. In heaping praise on the rioters, Trump is shifting blame for his own role in the run-up to the bloody mob siege and asking voters to absolve hundreds of them and himself over the deadliest attack on a seat of American power in 200 years. Five people, it should be noted, including four law enforcement officials who were brutally beaten by the insurrectionists, died during the Trump-incited insurrection and in its aftermath. Taken together, It's what those who study authoritarian regimes warn is a classic case of what's called consolidation, where the state apparatus is being transformed around a singular figure, in this case, Trump, the guy up there who kept his hat on during the national anthem and the Pledge of Allegiance. Jason Stanley, a philosophy professor at Yale, said, in history, the question comes up over and over again. How could people not have taken an authoritarian leader at his word about what was going to happen? Listen to Trump, he urged. When a coup against the democratic regime happens and it is not punished, that is a very strong indicator of the end of the rule of law and the victory of that authoritarian movement, said Stanley, who is the author of the book, How Fascism Works. Americans, he said, have a hard time understanding that what happens in most of the world, yes, can happen here too. Over the weekend, Trump also focused his attention on Liz Cheney, the former Republican congresswoman who was vice chair of the House January 6 Select Committee. Quote, she should go to jail, along with the rest of the Unselect Committee, Trump posted on social media. Now, you may not like what the January 6th committee did. You may not like Liz Cheney. You may not like what she had to say, along with the rest of the committee. But they should go to jail for what? I think at this point, it doesn't actually matter. Cheney posted in response, quote, if your response to Trump's assault on our democracy is to lie and cover up what he did, attack the brave men and women who came forward with the truth, and defend the criminals who violently assaulted the Capitol, you need to rethink whose side you're on. Hint, it's not America's. But of course, the remarks by Trump over the weekend that are getting the most coverage, perhaps justifiably, are his threat of a bloodbath for the country if he does not win this November.
We're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars if I get elected. Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
Mm-hmm. Got that? The cars. The 100% tariff on the cars coming from
China,
that will be the least of it. That will be the least of the bloodbath for the country if I don't get elected this year. Now, Trump supporters have been feigning outrage that the mainstream media is highlighting Trump's vow that it would be a bloodbath for the country if he doesn't get elected, but they're outraged because he was only talking about a bloodbath for cars, I guess, and the economy or something. That's what they're pretending that he was referring to. You must report on the context, the full context of his remarks. Well, of course, I have already done so. The context for those remarks, the full context, was in fact the full rally in which he made those remarks. The pledging of allegiance to convicted criminals who attempted to overthrow the Constitution and the U.S. government. The immigrants that he repeatedly described throughout the rally as animals and monsters and not people. That was throughout his remarks. His reference almost 20 times to a stolen election that was not stolen in any way, shape, or form. And what would happen if he doesn't win again? Well, it will be a bloodbath for the country. That's the context. Back to historian and fascism expert Timothy Snyder on this today. He writes, the people who say that the car context rescues Trump ignore the meaningful contexts. History. Trump. The opening of the rally. What he said in the speech in general. Focusing on the cars has the effect of casting away the fascist overture and rest of the speech and all of the other contexts. Those who speciously insist that Trump had in mind an automotive bloodbath never mentioned that he had just celebrated criminals. He had repeated the big lie. He had dehumanized people. and he had followed other fascist patterns. That is the context. In this sense, Trump's defenders are the ones who are taking Trump's remarks out of context, notes Snyder. The apologists suggest that Trump is being unfairly attacked, that he is once again, as always, the real victim here. That sort of claim, of course, reinforces the martyrdom narrative, which is, by the way, central to his campaign and, by the way, central to fascists throughout history, as Snyder notes, including the rise of the Third Reich. The meaningful contexts, notes Snyder, make Trump's summons to violence clearer and worse. That said, if we knew nothing about the history of political violence or about Trump or about the rest of his appearance in Vandalia, Ohio, the meaning of bloodbath for the country would still be absolutely clear to anyone who just listened to him. Even if we play the bad faith syntactical game that his defenders want us to play, there is really no doubt that he was talking about a bloodbath when he spoke about a bloodbath. The auto industry, he says, is, quote, the least of it. If he is not elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the country. He repeats that the auto industry is the least of it. So, yes, the words about cars are part of the context in that sense that if you pay attention to them, you know that he does not actually mean an automotive bloodbath. According to George Conway, the husband or the now former husband of senior Trump White House advisor and his former campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, on Twitter, quote, there's some commentary saying we should disregard Trump's bloodbath remarks last night because he was talking about potential harms to the auto industry. That, says Conway, is misguided. It makes no difference to his malicious intent or to the danger that he and his rhetoric poses. What matters is that he consistently uses apocalyptic and violent language in an indiscriminate fashion as a result of his psychopathy and correlative authoritarian tendencies, and because he is just plain evil. It's a classic trait and technique of authoritarian demagogues, writes Conway. He catastrophizes everything to rile up his cultish supporters and to bind them to him and to make them willing to do his bidding. That's dangerous all around because he's encouraging them to believe that conditions are so bad and will become so bad and that the political opposition is so awful that anything is justified, including lawbreaking and, yes, violence, to prevent those conditions and to destroy the opposition. And so, writes Conway, it doesn't matter what he's specifically referring to at the moment. He could be talking about trans people in public bathrooms, or the state of the auto industry, or the border. It doesn't matter. He's a dangerous psychopath. And after more than 8 years of watching his sick behavior, we must not give him the benefit of the doubt, writes George Conway, a longtime conservative. TPM's Josh Marshall had this observation. He said, in wars, in sports, in virtually every competitive domain in life, it is a given that the side maintaining the initiative, forcing the other side to react rather than dictate the course of events, has an overwhelming advantage. And that is 90% of Trump's game. The first step out of that game is not to get gummed up interpreting it and reacting to it. If there may have been some confusion about this one statement, about the context of this one statement, that's because Trump routinely threatens violence. He threatens the most brazen abuses of public trust, all to frighten and keep his political adversaries off balance and to keep them scared. And he does that not only for that reason, but because he actually will use violence to hold on to power. It is not a threat. He has already done it.
He's a lawless bully who will toss out the Constitution, refuse to accept the results of an election, and work with enemy foreign powers, all for his own personal power. Says Josh, I mean, we literally know all of this. It is not speculation. He has done all of that already. If a mob boss says someone is going to sleep with the fishes, I'm not going to get into an argument about whether that person has a big aquarium in his bedroom because he's a mob boss and I'm not a chump, and murdering people is what he does. It can be difficult because civic-minded people find it a challenge to grapple with lawless degenerates, but it can be done. And I would add, it must be done. And it must be done at the ballot box this year. The real patriots, the ones we should be saluting, the Americans who stand up to strong men and tyrants and self-declared kings, are the ones who, if we are to be saved, will save us this year. And that would include you. And yes, we're going to have a lot of snarky comments between here and November about how we were always told this is the most important election of our lifetimes. But if you don't think it is, if you think you can sit this one out because, oh, you know, both parties, they're the same, a pox on both their houses, they're both terrible, well, then I might suggest you may want to build a moat around your house, because the strongman will be coming for you. As everyone who has studied strongmen in history is desperately trying to tell us. If you think this election is just a choice between two old white guys, it's always the same, well, then you either haven't been paying attention or you have been horribly ill-served by the media and the social media that you follow, or, yeah, you have already drunk the Kool-Aid. More Bradcast is straight ahead today. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Yeah. Have already lost our minds. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. And I mean that. The system is already breaking down thanks to the last time that Donald Trump was allowed by American voters to be the president, when he and Republicans were allowed to then steal a corrupt Supreme Court supermajority. A divided Supreme Court, largely on administrative grounds, on Tuesday, allowed Texas to begin enforcing a law that gives local and state police broad powers to arrest migrants suspected of crossing the border illegally, even while a legal battle plays out over the measure itself. The far-right majority's order rejects an emergency application from the Biden administration, which says the law is a clear violation of federal authority that would upset more than a century of American immigration authority. The high court didn't address whether or not the law is constitutional, though, frankly, allowing it to take effect even for now would certainly seem to show their hand. The measure now goes back to the even farther right U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and will almost certainly return back to the Supreme Court. But in the meantime, it was not clear how soon Texas might begin arresting migrants under the law before the law's merits will actually be adjudicated by the U.S. Supreme Court, which has, administratively or not, now allowed the federal primacy clause of the U.S. Constitution, which says that federal law takes precedent over state law, especially in matters of immigration and federal U.S. border law, that's just been overturned.
The majority did not write a detailed opinion in the case. They just refused to put a stay on this law and let it proceed. Trump appointee Justice Amy Coney Barrett, in a concurring opinion that was joined by Trump appointee Brett Kavanaugh, suggested that her vote in favor of Texas stemmed from technicalities of the appeals process rather than an agreement with the state on the substance of the law. So just let it move forward because, you know, technicalities. We'll worry about the substance later. The decision to let the law go into effect, however, drew dissents from liberal justices Ketanji Brown Jackson, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor. Quote, the court gives a green light to a law that will upend the longstanding federal-state balance of power and sow chaos. That's what Sotomayor wrote in a what AP describes as a blistering dissent joined by Jackson. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre called the law, quote, harmful and unconstitutional and said it would burden law enforcement while creating confusion. She called on Congress, congressional Republicans to settle the issue with a federal border security bill. One that, not unlike the very conservative bipartisan border bill that was recently hammered out in the U.S. Senate, only to be killed by Donald Trump, who insisted that Congress not fix whatever problems exist at the border so he'd have something to run on this year in the election. Apparently, it's not such a crisis after all. Though the state of Texas is now pretending that it is, and the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court is allowing them to do so. For its part, Texas has argued that it has a right to take action over what authorities have called an ongoing crisis at the southern border. Apparently not much of one, though, because Trump doesn't want to do anything about it, at least until he's in office next year. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice said in a statement that it is, quote, prepared to handle any influx in population associated with the state law. Other Texas officials sounded a cautious note, saying, quote, a lot of the local police chiefs here, we don't believe it will survive a constitutional challenge. It doesn't look like it's going to because a Texas peace officer is not trained, said Sheriff Eddie Guerra of Hidalgo County. He serves as president of the Southwestern Border Sheriffs Coalition, representing 31 border counties from Texas to California. He said, we have no training whatsoever to determine whether an individual is here in this country legally. The Supreme Court in 2012 struck down key parts of an Arizona law that would have allowed police to arrest people for federal immigration violations, often referred to by opponents as the Show Me Your Papers law. But, you know, that was 2012, so many years ago now. There's no need, you know, at least for a while, to follow court precedent on that matter. I know it was 2012, but that was so long ago. You know, despite the fact that, you know, one right-wing Supreme Court justice after another, going all the way back to Clarence Thomas, they've all said during their Senate confirmation hearings how they are such true believers in stare decisis, in following precedent of the court. Apparently they were just kidding, though I suspect a few million women in this country already figured that out after the right to reproductive care and abortion was overturned by these very same corrupt liars. I think Mark Joseph Stern is going to be joining us on our next broadcast.
Yes, yes, he is.
I suspect this matter may come up. Anyway, speaking of corrupt liars hoping to undermine precedent and American tradition for political purposes, House Majority Whip Tom Emmer of Minnesota said GOP leadership should reconsider how they invite presidents to give the State of the Union address, citing President Biden's, quote, divisive speech 2 weeks ago, which is hilarious that Republicans think Joe Biden's speeches are divisive. Of course, they don't actually think that, but, you know. Emmer argued Biden's remarks were, quote, hyper-partisan. Told Axios the president should not be invited to address Congress next year if he's elected to a second term. Now, you think they'll feel that same way if Donald Trump is elected next year to a second term? He can come. He's never divisive or hyper-political. Emmer is not the first Republican, however, to float blocking Biden from giving the annual speech. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa, introduced a bill that was aimed at barring Trump, Biden from delivering the speech this year, I think, unless he submitted his budget and national security proposal on time. Because, you know, Republicans hate being late with federal budgets. And former House Freedom Caucus Chair Scott Perry of Pennsylvania called for Speaker Mike Johnson to rescind his invitation unless Biden took a stronger action to address securing the border. You know, like the stronger action that Speaker Mike Johnson blocked as a favor to Donald Trump after the Senate actually worked out such stronger action. Something that was unheard of during State of the Union addresses, the heckling of President Biden. This has become an increasingly partisan affair, these Republicans are noting, after they were the ones who heckled him over each of the last 2 years. Nobody had ever done that before until Republicans started doing it during the Obama administration because, you know, they hate divisiveness and partisanship during the State of the Union. Republicans have attempted to paint Biden's very well-received speech as angry and divisive ahead of the 24 election, with multiple members pointing to the lack of a bump in the polls as a sign that it was not well-received, reports Axios today. Of course, if it was not well-received, why would Republicans want the Democratic president to not deliver the State of the Union to Congress? The answer, of course, is that it was well-received, and they don't want to let that happen again. If it's a Republican president, of course, there will be no talk. There will be zero talk.
Now, of course, you're
of not allowing him or her to speak.
Yes, and you know that's a logical assessment. And of course, the Republicans in Congress realize that their followers, their supporters, are not going to think that through, and they're not. They're going to be totally fine with the idea.
Or you know, it's because Donald Trump is not nearly as hyper-partisan and divisive as Joe Biden is. Anyway, that said, it's kind of fun that they're trying to argue that Biden's speech was not well received when we actually know that is simply not true from folks who actually watched the speech and told the media how they felt about it right afterward. A majority who tuned in had a positive response to President Biden's State of the Union address, according to a CNN flash poll that was conducted on the night that it happened, and they reported on it the next morning. More than 6 in 10, or 64% specifically, of Americans who watched the speech had an either somewhat or very positive reaction to the president's message, according to the survey. The sample for this poll leaned slightly more Democratic than the public is at large. But CNN notes it's typical for more Democrats to tune in when a Democratic president is delivering the State of the Union, as it is for Republicans to watch the address when it's a Republican president. But digging a bit deeper here, there's an important point in this survey, which was, frankly, the bigger takeaway for me. Prior to the address, as CNN notes, the same respondents were asked if they thought Biden's policies are moving the United States in the right direction. 45% of speech watchers before the speech said that Biden was moving the country where it needs to go. But after the speech, 62% said the same. Sounds like a well-received speech to me. That's a 17-point bump from before the speech until right after the speech. Still, Biden's State of the Union addresses, CNN notes, have been more well-received in the past, but Washington Post notes another important caveat there as well. The CNN sample was 36% Democratic, 30% Republican. Generally speaking, members of a president's party will outnumber members of the opposite party by double digits. In this case, it was only by 6 points. Perhaps because it's an election year, perhaps because Republicans have focused so much on whether Joe Biden was even capable of, you know, making the stairs up to the podium to give his address 2 weeks ago. For whatever reason, there were a lot more Republicans tuning in this year as compared to previous addresses. There was just a lot more people overall, by the way, almost 30 million, which is huge numbers for a State of the Union address in the modern era. And it means that there were a lot more Republicans in the survey sample compared to Democrats than, you know, compared to previous years. So even if he had Biden had the same numbers before and after this year, that would still be very good news for Joe Biden because there was a whole bunch more Republicans in the sample for that survey. And CNN's survey was not the only one that found similar. Navigator Research posted similar findings from its live reaction dial group. This was people who were watching during the thing and reacting positively or negatively by turning the dial up or down. So this was a live reaction dial group of 33 so-called soft partisans and independents in the Phoenix area. 76% of them had positive reactions, with 64% saying Biden's policies would move the country in the right direction. His favorability rating among the dial group jumped 37 points from before and after the speech, ending at 58% favorable to 42% unfavorable. So even if you have a problem with the makeup of these polls or the size of the sample, 33 people is not a very big sample size to go on. You're judging apples to apples. You're judging the way the very same people felt before versus the way they felt after watching the speech. And it's a jump of 37 points in their positive reaction from the same people before and after the speech. Other than that, it was not well received at all. So according to Navigator testing, it's not just on how they feel in general positive, but a whole bunch of specific items. Biden's biggest improvement from pre to post speech came in five areas, and the improvements were enormous. Biden stands up to corporations. There was a net change in how the people felt about that of 83 points.
Wow.
That Joe Biden is a strong leader. A net change of 63 points before and after the State of the Union address. That Joe Biden is up for the job of president. A net change of 60 points. That Joe Biden represents the U.S. well abroad, a net change of 46 points, and Joe Biden brings people together, a net positive change of 40 points. So, the speech was not well received, Congressman Emmer? Really? Apparently was. And apparently, that's why you hope to prevent it from happening again next year. At least if the pro-democracy candidate wins. Desi Doyen and the Green News Report are next. I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. The Bradcast survives thanks to you and your support. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today to help us continue to do over your public airwaves what we try to do 5 days a week. That's bradblog.com/donate, and thank you. I told you we had a busy show today.
I know.
A lot to get to. And by the way, that was before we get to even our latest Green News Report.
Asbestos is known to cause several types of cancer and is linked to more than 40,000 deaths in the United States annually.
EPA finally bans all uses of asbestos in the U.S. after decades of trying.
Sadly, too many communities across America face the loss of wealth, prosperity, and the possibilities that still reverberate today.
President Biden unveils billions for rebuilding struggling communities torn apart years ago by highway construction. Plus, coastal town spends big on beach restoration that washed away days later.
Oh, man. All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and
snarky comment.
And what's going to happen to coastal communities like this? You don't believe them?
No,
or
I'm not a climate change guy.
Well, then no need to worry. If you're not a climate change guy, climate change isn't a problem. Don't stop not believing. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, lots of important stories today, but once again, we've got to start with redonkulous heat records.
Yes, unfortunately. In South Sudan, in Central Africa, officials have closed down all schools starting on Monday and warned parents to keep children indoors due to an extreme heat wave expected to persist for weeks, with temperatures topping 113 degrees Fahrenheit. Much of South Africa is mired in extreme drought, suffering the driest February in decades, which has killed crops, curtailed electricity from dams, and caused severe, widespread water shortages in the city of Johannesburg. Scientists link the extreme heat and drought in Africa to man-made climate change.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., new data indicates that spring is getting warmer and arriving earlier on average nationwide. That's across nearly 230 U.S. cities analyzed by Climate Central. This year, Washington, D.C.'s famous cherry blossoms tied for their second earliest peak bloom on record. The short winter and early spring of 2024 is also influenced by a warming El Nino. But overall, man-made climate change is causing shifts in the bloom times and ranges of various plant species, according to USDA maps, and that is affecting wildlife, causing a timing mismatch between animals and the plants they rely on for food, which can affect their ability to reproduce, especially for birds. Early springs also hit allergy sufferers. A new study finds that North America's pollen seasons are now 20 days longer than they were in 1990.
Yeah, maybe, but, you know, I'm not a climate change guy.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration on Wednesday unveiled more than $3 billion in funding from the Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act to reconnect and rebuild communities split by highways and other infrastructure projects that disproportionately demolished Black and low-income communities.
Good.
With economic consequences that still reverberate today.
Yes.
Here's President Biden announcing the unprecedented initiative in Milwaukee late last week.
I'm here to announce the first of its kind investment, $3.3 billion in 132 projects in 42 states going to help right historic wrongs.
And after more than 30 years of effort, on Monday, the Environmental Protection Agency unveiled a comprehensive ban on all uses of toxic asbestos in the United States. The deadly carcinogen kills an estimated 40,000 Americans every year and was still used in some products in the U.S. decades after a partial ban was enacted. It's the first chemical banned under a 2016 chemical safety law signed by President Obama that finally gave the EPA broad authority to regulate tens of thousands of unregulated toxic chemicals in everyday products.
Finally, decades after every other reasonable country has already done it.
Yep. And finally, the residents of a coastal Massachusetts town spent $600,000 of their own money to truck in sand to restore a stretch of beach eroded by storms and rising seas in order to protect their homes. A storm washed it away in just days. The homeowners now want state taxpayers to fund more temporary sacrificial dunes in perpetuity. But the state doesn't fund beach restoration on private property. One homeowner offered a telling detail in an interview with CNN.
As long as you keep rebuilding, it's not going to go away.
Do you believe in climate change? Don't believe in that?
No, I don't believe in that, no. I'm not a climate change guy. I don't believe that this beach will be gone and destroyed 20 years from now, 30 years from now.
But will it take $1 million worth of sand every year to keep it?
It might, but you've got a couple of... You have $2 billion in property here. We just need the state to help with the funding to protect the properties.
Well, you just keep believing that, buddy. I'm sure it'll all work out great. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Don't stop believing.
Yeah. It's not gonna. No, I don't believe. I'm not a climate change guy. I don't believe in that whole climate change thing. And it's fine if we take $1 million from the state. They're gonna give
every
us
every year.
Every year,
as long as it takes forever.
Right, because. There's $2 billion of property here, so they're not going to let that go away.
$2 billion of private property that we invested in that we want state taxpayers to help pay for.
We want you to give us our money to save our beach, and but don't ask us to forgive student loans, because that would be outrageous. To take other people's money and give it to forgive people's student loans, that would be outrageous.
Crazy talk.
But give us that money to save our pretty beach.
Yeah, and you know, he says, what are you going to do?
What an idiot.
Just lose $2 billion in private property? Yes. Yes, that is exactly what is going to happen. Sea level rise cannot be stopped.
Yeah, I don't believe it. I'm not a climate change guy.
And he would be doing much better with his money if he started thinking about where he's going to move to.
Yeah,
and where the rest of that community is going to move to, because that's going to be really expensive, and it's not going to get any cheaper than it is today.
Yeah, it'll all be fine. Everything will be just the same 20 years from now. No
Lord
worries.
Help us from climate deniers. They are so freaking expensive, and they're going to get more expensive for the rest of us.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it and listen to it and enjoy it or hate it anytime you like for free at bradblog.com. That, of course, made possible by those of you kind enough to hit one of those donate buttons at Bradblog, or just go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Hey, do you think we can get $1 million from the state each year to do the Bradcast? Where was I? Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog.
And I am the, Green News Report. So
you
please come by.
You are Green News Report.
Yes.
All right. Yes. Go by, say hello to her. And by the way, because we've been like, Elon Musk, since he's taken over, our posts do not get shared the way they used to. So if you do follow us and if you do see our posts, whether it's Green News Report or The Brad Blog, please hit like and share. That
yes.
will help many other people see it. A lot more people used to see it until Elon came around. All right, that's it. We're out of here. We will see you there at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, same Brad time, same Brad channel. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Don't stop believing. Hold on to that feeling. Streetlight people. Don't stop believing.
I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day the United States Supreme Court upheld the Adamson Act. The act had initially been passed and signed into law the previous September to avoid a nationwide railway strike. It established the 8-hour workday and overtime pay for interstate railroad workers. The four railroad brotherhoods, the engineers, firemen, brakemen, and conductors, had been pushing for these terms since at least 1915. When the railroads refused to budge, the unions prepared to strike. It was the first federal law that sought to determine minimum wages and maximum hours for private industry. The railroads were furious with President Woodrow Wilson for demanding quick passage of the law. They filed the case Wilson versus New, which challenged the constitutionality of the act. The railroads refused to abide by the new law while they waited for their case to be heard, ultimately by the U.S. Supreme Court. The four railroad brotherhoods grew tired of waiting and organized for another strike. The court rejected the railroad's claim and upheld the act. President Wilson had hoped to ensure labor peace as the United States was on the cusp of entering World War I. Seen as a powerful victory for the unions, the railway employees pressed for similar demands. When the industry looked as though it was headed for yet another strike, President Wilson exercised the Army Appropriations Act and issued an executive order at the end of 1917 that placed the railroads under federal control. This nationalized the railroad industry into three divisions under the newly established United States Railroad Administration between the years of 1917 and 1920. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Hi, everybody. Juliana Forlano here from the Juliana Forlano Show on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Do you like to know what's going on in the world but don't like walking away from your news show feeling all depressed or jacked up? Do you like political humor? Then check out our show, The Juliana Forlano Show, Saturday at 11 a.m., Sunday at 9 p.m. on the Progressive Voices Network, or find us at julianaforlano.com.